Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on October 6, 2018. My Dhamma talk in our Sangha discussion is the third in a series of talks on the meaning of jhana. This talk will be on the Samadanga Sutta. In the Sutta, the Buddha teaches five factors of concentration that relate directly to four levels of jhana or meditative absorption. And this sutta is remarkable in the scope of underlying Dhamma reference. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Pete. Today's talk, again, is a series. I think this is the third or fourth in this series on jhana. The first two talks really were describing these different levels of meditative absorption from giving a descriptive view in specific contexts. This is more of an analysis of jhana. It goes a little bit more in depth. And there'll be a few more talks in this series on jhana. And then included in here, maybe at the end, I'll be giving a talk on something known as the Arya Pariyasana Sutta. Those of you with great memories, remember the Pariyasana Sutta, which is a sutta on noble searches in general. The Arya Pariyasana Sutta is a sutta where the Buddha is describing in really remarkable detail his own noble search and what he found was in part of aspects of ignoble searches, meaning whatever you want to find, if you're looking in the wrong place, you can't find it. And in that, he eventually tells the story of meeting his five friends post his awakening and how he teaches them jhana and then specifically what to avoid. And it's very useful. And some of those things are touched on here in this sutta. It's important to remember that, like all the Buddha sutta, this is taught in the context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths. And that the only meditation method the Buddha ever taught was to deepen concentration, and it was Shamatha Vipassana meditation. There's other things that the Buddha taught that we should think about or contemplate, but he never taught those as something, these subjects, to be something incorporated into a meditation practice. Because if you think about that, if I'm thinking about the nature of compassion or the nature of impermanence, using my own body as an object, perhaps, and that's the meditation on the eternal grounds, it's often called, where the Buddha gets into a lengthy description of what happens to a body once it dies and how it starts decomposing, etc., etc. And that has been taken to become this modern meditation on charnel grounds, where the Buddha just taught that from a well-concentrated mind, if you simply consider what happens to us and how quickly it can happen, we can die and just rot away, it's an expedient towards taking to the Dhamma. It's much like the Bahiya Sutta. We realize that we don't have forever to do this, let's get to it and awaken to understand the impermanence. Ultimately, the Buddha taught that the entire Dhamma, including the meditation method used, is to develop profound right view. And profound right view, awakened right view, is a profound and penetrative understanding of suffering. It's a profound understanding of the origination of suffering. It's a profound understanding of the cessation of suffering. And it's a profound understanding of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. And of course, that's all experiential. We begin any study, and certainly including study of the Buddha's teachings, intellectually. And then the Buddha taught us that from that intellectual understanding, rooted in a concentration practice, Shamatha Vipassana meditation, we can then take it off our cushions and have the direct experience of awakening. In other words, there's nothing that is taken on faith. And much of these descriptive suttas on jhana are just that, describing the results of a well-concentrated meditation practice, which is much like the Anapanasati Sutta. Another Anapanasati means breath awareness. And that is often taught as a standalone meditation practice. In other words, there's many people that would say, well, I teach Anapanasati because they teach some variant of breath meditation. But the Buddha didn't teach that as instruction. He taught it as a description of accomplished monks and nuns who, and a description of their actual practice rather than a description of or an instruction on to meditate. Is that clear, or am I making you more confused? So the meditation method the Buddha taught is a very simple and direct method. One factor of eight, it's the eighth factor, and it doesn't mean that it's it's an eighth level of importance. The Eightfold Path, the eight-factor path, is a singular practice with eight components, all equally important in developing a complete Dhamma practice. So, and then just a little bit of an introduction to some words that I'll be using here that are sometimes confusing. Rapture has two connotations, doesn't it? It relates to the second coming of Christ, if we're into that. But it's often used in the translations from the Pali, especially Tanisera's translations, to the English, to simply mean joyful engagement with the Dhamma practice. It's almost, you could use the word enraptured with our Dhamma practice. We've got to be careful that we're not taking that to an extreme, that that itself becomes a distraction. So it simply means a joyful engagement with the Dhamma. Directed thought is something that is often misunderstood. Directed thought has two components in Dhamma practice. One is it's simply the thoughts that we have that are distracting us in our meditation practice and then off our cushions, but also even the refined directed thought about what I should be doing in meditation practice. So, excuse me. It takes a measure of directed thought to begin our meditation practice, doesn't it? I'm going to meditate. And when I meditate, I'm going to be mindful of our breath, of my breath. That's a directed thought. That gets us into the beginning stages of meditation. It starts to develop concentration by being mindful of the breath. And as we deepen our concentration, even that directed thought of being mindful of the breath and evaluating, another aspect of directed thought is directed thought and evaluation, is valuing what's occurring in our minds, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, whether it's past, present, or future. That's all part of directed thought and evaluation. And as we deepen our concentration, that simply falls away. It's not something that we force out of our minds. It's just, again, another level of deepening concentration. And the last explanation is the word samsara. And samsara, again, has mystical connotations that the Buddha never intended. Samsara simply means wandering around in ignorance. Ignorance of what? Ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So again, putting it all back into context. Any questions about what I just said? Okay. The Samadanga Sutta, the five factors of concentration. On one occasion, the Buddha was in Savatthi, Ajita's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. He addressed those gathered. Friends, I will teach you five-factor noble concentration. Listen and pay close attention. And what is the five-factor noble concentration? A follower of the Noble Eightfold Path is quite secluded from sensuality and other unskillful mental qualities. Other unskillful mental qualities are anything that would be distracting us out of that moment. The short list is anything that is generated by greed, aversion, or deluded thinking, anything that is rooted in ignorance. And as I'm reading this, think about your own meditation practice, because the importance of these teachings is that we are developing this just as the Buddha teaches. When I first came across the jhanas, it was presented as this is only for advanced meditators who have been meditating for millions of years. The Buddha never taught anything like that. These levels of meditative absorptions we all experience in every meditation session, we just might not be aware of them. And the importance of the teachings is to be aware of them so we can accurately evaluate our own meditation practice. That, yes, I am deepening concentration during the actual practice. So notice how these are experienced directly by each and every one of you. Buddha continues. They enter and remain in the first jhana. The first jhana is experience of rapture, joyful engagement, born of that very seclusion. It is accompanied by directed thoughts and evaluation. The joy of seclusion permeates their entire mind and body. And again, this isn't an excitable joy. It's a gentle joy of the pure pleasure of having this refuge within our own minds. And that should be generate joyful engagement, shouldn't it? We found a place of refuge, a pure safety, a pure calm within ourselves. It's a remarkable thing. And it's done by being mindful of the breath and the body. The Buddha continues, It is as if one poured bath powder into a brass basin, kneading the powder into the water, sprinkling more and more powder, forming a ball of bath powder, saturated and moisture-laden. It would, nevertheless, not lose a drop of its own substance. This is how a follower of the Noble Eightfold Path permeates the entire mind and body from the joy born of seclusion. So we had an interesting talk about the use of metaphor as a teaching tool. And the Buddha used this often. There's much metaphor in the Sutta Pitaka for a few reasons. One is to use metaphor to describe distracted and agitated mind states, such as the use of Mara, the malevolent god Mara. When Mara is used in a sutta, in the Buddha describing something, he's using that metaphor common at his time, during his time, to describe an agitated mind state, a mind that is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And then at other ways to describe an elevated type of mindfulness, where he might be using deities to describe a certain quality of mind. And then sometimes it's just a descriptive story. Some people have difficulty using metaphor because we take it, our minds have worked that way, we take it way too literally. And if you stretch any metaphor, you lose its value. So it's just a way of creating a mental picture of what the Buddha is trying to teach. So think about the initial stage of meditation. We come into our meditation practice, however we're sitting, wherever we do it, hopefully it's a secluded spot. Again, the Buddha's gave very spare instruction on meditation outside of the Satipatthana Sutta. And the other suttas that teach the singular method of Shamatha Vipassana meditation, such as the Yoganatha Sutta. But he would always say, go find the root of a tree or an empty hut and do jhana, meaning find a secluded spot and engage in a practice that increases concentration. That was his basic instruction. And so now if you think about our own practice, we're coming to our cushion, we begin to quiet our minds, and as soon as we put our mind on, or become mindful of the breath and the body, our minds naturally calm. And that is the beginning of this joyful engagement with the Dhamma, that if we're mindful of it, will in that moment permeate our entire being. If we're taking to our meditation practice without the proper understanding, and we all do this when we begin a meditation practice, we haven't developed it yet, but we'll often look at meditation as an escape or a tool to fix a broken self or to contemplate mystical and magical teachings or to do deity worship or even to use sound or smells as part of our practice. The Buddha taught to recognize and abandon all of that and take pure joy in mindfulness of the breath. That's all he ever taught. So as we begin our practice, we become mindful of our breath. Our mind starts to calm, but we're still engaging in directed thought and evaluation of what's occurring. That's the first level of meditative absorption. A simple way of saying all those words I just used is it's just appreciation for what we're doing, that we have this wonderful practice to engage in. Did I say that last? Their entire mind and body permeated from the joy born of seclusion. This is the first development of the five-factor noble concentration. Does anybody feel that they can't develop that first factor, the first level? It's just a natural occurrence of meditation, isn't it? The proper meditation practice. Again, one of the reasons why I'm teaching this is to help us all fine-tune our meditation practice in relation to how the Buddha taught us to fine-tune it, but also to display some of the myths that many people, including those online, have heard about jhanas and deepening concentration and meditation that the Buddha taught. The Buddha continues. Furthermore, as a stilling of directed thought and evaluation, they enter and remain in the second jhana. The second jhana is experienced as rapture and pleasure born of concentration. From the pleasure and the joy of seclusion, the next level, again, nothing magical or mystical, is simply acknowledging that my mind's becoming more concentrated. And again, each and every one of us experiences this, whether we realize it or not. And again, that's one of the reasons why the Buddha teaches us, to realize it, to notice that we're deepening our concentration. The joy of concentration permeates the entire mind and body. It is as if a lake with no inflow is filled with spring water welling up within and from abundant showers. The cool water welling up from within the lake would permeate and fill the entire lake. This is how a follower of the Noble Eightfold Path permeates their entire mind and body from the joy born of concentration. It's just, again, we had this interesting conversation. So the visual, if you take it too far, is going to be probably distracting. But if you just think about, in this moment of meditation, I'm filling up my entire being with the joy. It doesn't mean that we've developed, we may not have developed a high level of concentration, but just the fact that we have this practice is enough to fill my being with the joy of a concentration practice. Think about the brilliance of this teacher, excuse me, from 2,600 years ago. He didn't just say, and I won't get into it too deep about my engagement with modern Buddhism, but he doesn't just say, go and meditate and this is what you do. Although I spent many years in a place that was basically it. You go sit there and you better sit perfectly with no other real context. The Buddha understood our own ignorance of Four Noble Truths, and what that ignorance does is it creates very powerful and subtle strategies to continue to ignore our own ignorance, including in a meditation practice that is designed for deepening concentration to incorporate that need to ignore ignorance as in a form of distracting practices and not recognizing what's occurring. In other words, it's very convenient for a mind that is committed to ignorance to ignore its own development, isn't it? It's a pretty powerful and subtle strategies that a mind rooted in ignorance will employ. And the Buddha's brilliance is to even recognize that subtlety of the practice and say, be mindful that it's working. Ehepisiko, come and see for yourself. If that was one of the Buddha's main charges in developing Dhamma practice, then of course he would teach a way of recognizing it. And he frames that beautifully in this sutta and other suttas, and also in the Satipatthana and the Anapanasati Sutta. How to view your own development and where to put your mindfulness on. Is that clear? Okay. This is how a follower of the Noble Eightfold Path permeates the entire mind and body from the joy of concentration. This is the second development of the five-factor noble concentration. Would everybody agree that you've experienced that? Maybe not being mindful of permeating your entire being with the joy of concentration, but you've noticed that concentration is increasing simply by being mindful of your breath or coming back to the sensation of breathing in your body. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. That's the second level of jhana. And again, I'm not diminishing these in importance, but to recognize something that we should be developing further, we first have to recognize it where we are, isn't it? Whatever level of concentration we have, acknowledge that we're there. The Buddha continues. Let me finish that. Furthermore, as rapture fades, they remain equanimous, mindful, alert, and sensitive to pleasure. Again, we're sensitive and conscious beings. Sensitive to pleasure does not mean that we're seeking it anymore. We are simply using our senses to be sensitive to what's occurring. Equanimous is a word that simply means a deepening level of concentration. Our minds are resting in equanimity, meaning just a balanced state, no matter what's occurring. Mindful and alert. Excuse me. Refers to another deepening level of concentration, doesn't it? Our mindfulness is increasing, meaning in a general way we're able to start expanding our concentration to include what we've learned. Excuse me. What we've learned about right view, and I won't get too deep into that. I will later. And so this third jhana, this third level of meditative absorption, is characterized by the diminishing of directed thought and simply a momentary, but it could last for minutes and minutes, pleasant abiding in a calm and peaceful mind. But it's not yet pure. In other words, we're in a third level of jhana. We recognize a deeper level of concentration, and for a few moments or a few minutes, we might simply be mindful of our breath, but eventually we'll find ourselves back into our normal thought process again. And that doesn't diminish the third jhana, it simply means that we're not quite there yet. Right? The entry made in the third jhana, which is equanimous and mindful, a pleasant abiding. With the fading of rapture, this pleasant abiding permeates their entire mind and body. So again, and please answer me, if the question, if the answer is no, have you all experienced that third level of jhana? Mm-hmm. Where your mind is at calm, is calm and at peace, and in the moment, that's enough for you. You're not seeking anything else, right? That's the third level of jhana. Again, it's not something, it's extraordinary to the a normal human mind that is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, because that's a constant state of distraction, or more or less a constant state of distraction. So it's extraordinary in relation to that, but it's completely ordinary as part of a Dhamma, a meditation practitioner within the framework of the Buddhist Dhamma. And again, I don't want to sound like I'm overemphasizing that point, but it's so important to understand that everything the Buddha taught, including this simple indirect meditation method, is useful, applicable, and easily developed by any human being. It doesn't take any special qualities or special dispensations or special grace from some disincarnate being. We can all do it just by engaging in the practice. The Buddha continues with a metaphor. It is as if a pond is permeated with red, white, and blue lotus, born and growing immersed in the water. They flourish permeated with cool water from the root to the tip, never standing above the surface. And that's really just a line to explain there's nothing ordinary about being a lotus flower, isn't it? But a lotus flower is always permeated by its environment. And the metaphor is that we create this environment in our mind where we're permeated with concentration, with calm, with peace. It's interesting that... There is a metaphor that's used in transcendental meditation that is similar to that, but it doesn't go that far. The other interesting thing about this is in the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, the Buddha uses this metaphor again, and then he uses the metaphor of the few lotus flowers that are actually able to come out of that murky water and come into the fresh air and bloom. He uses that aspect of this metaphor to describe an awakening human being. We've now come out of the murky water. We've bloomed. Buddha continues, this is how a follower of the Noble Eightfold Path permeates their entire mind and body from the joy born of the fading of rapture. This pleasant abiding permeates the entire mind and body. This is the third development of the five-factor noble concentration. Furthermore, with the abandoning of evaluation, they enter and remain in the fourth jhana. It's just a simple direction. With the fading of evaluation. So I'm sitting in my meditation practice. I'm noticing that my mind, my concentration is deepening. And now I find a quality of mind where I'm not even evaluating what's occurring, not just with my thoughts, within me. That's a mind united in the body. It's a mind that is mindfully present with your life as your life occurs. That's the ultimate goal that is developed with a foundation of right meditation, or Shamatha Vipassana meditation. So now the Buddha is explaining that ever-deepening level of concentration is becoming more visceral. We can notice it more. And the reason why I say it that way is that it doesn't mean that we enter this fourth jhana, and I'll describe that in just a moment, and we must somehow stay there off our cushion. Once it's developed, as we continue to develop it, we are more mindful of this mind that is just below the surface of the water, like the lotus flower. And no matter what's occurring on the surface, no matter how many ripples are up on the surface, Lorna used this almost inadvertently in relation to the metaphor a few years ago. No matter what's occurring on the surface, our mind is aware of it. It's connected. But it's at peace. And so I often say we gain the ability to be at peace with less than peaceful mind states. That's what the metaphor is useful for, in showing that. So no matter what's occurring, no matter what's swirling around in our minds and in our immediate environment, and take it further out into the world, which is certainly crazy today, but just as not any more crazy than it was during the Buddhist time, we can keep our minds just below the surface, detached from what's occurring in the world, but completely mindful of what's occurring. And we maintain this peaceful quality of mind. And so now do you see the practical benefits of right meditation, that we are introducing to ourselves in a direct and visceral way on our cushions what the quality of mind of an awakened human being is moment by moment, that fourth level of jhana. Is that clear? So it's so important to understand the relationship to right meditation and why the Buddha taught this in this singular way, because it supports the entire understanding and integration of the Eightfold Path. And so if I spend my time meditating and using a contemplative practice and not increasing my concentration, there's not even a connection then to the Eightfold Path. So if I'm substituting something, and again, the Buddha taught this, he never taught something that wasn't significantly important. He never wasted a word, which is really, when I read the suttas, it's amazing how he was like that. So the significance of teaching right meditation to the Buddha was paramount, because even during his time, there was such a distractive push to do everything out there that's offered. And that's how other teachers, even Kalama Sutta gets into this, how other teachers would all claim that this is the right, true way and we should do this and do that. And the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, the Buddha teaches how he studied with some very advanced so-called spiritual teachers, teaching different meditation methods that were used to establish a self in non-physical realms. And again, I'll get into that more when I teach that sutta. And discounting that is not leading to the goal of understanding the nature of human suffering. And if you take yourself, think about it, if you're using a method that distracts you completely out of your body, how can you gain any useful understanding of what occurs while you're in your body? That's one of the most brilliant things the Buddha awakened to, because all of the practices during his time were geared towards that. And again, I'm not going to get into a long description, I will in a week or two. But think about the brilliance of that and how the independence of this man that he was able to develop within this spiritual milieu that was insisting that he see things differently. He rose above, his example of the lotus flower, he rose above the surface of, the murky surface of local spirituality, really it was global spirituality, you could say it that way, and saw things differently. He saw things from right view. It all depends on using right meditation.
So is the ripple essentially the three marks?
That's it. Yes.
That he can either be below it, and because your refined development of your understanding of the three marks allows you to not have to intellectually understand it anymore, that it's just what you become.
Yeah, that's great. So when you deepen your concentration, it just takes a breath, by the way, to go from the rippled surface down below. You're no longer using the three defilements of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking to evaluate your Dhamma practice. And in having that experience again on your cushion allows you to take that off your cushion and recognize when it's coming up in your life. Thank you, David. Furthermore, with the abandoning of evaluation, they enter and remain in the fourth jhana. Not much difference between the third and fourth jhana, except this, which is pure equanimity and mindful. Pure equanimity. It just means that the essence of our calm mind is now pure. There's nothing interfering with it. But again, the Buddha is not putting a time frame on this. And there's nothing, I've never read anywhere in the suttas, and I read a great deal of them, where the Buddha puts a time frame on how long it should take to awaken or how long we should meditate. But then at the conclusion of the Satipatthana or the Anapanasati Sutta, he says, if you engage in this practice wholeheartedly, the way I teach it, not me, the way the Buddha teaches it, in 7 years, you'll awaken. And those of us that have been on retreat or heard me say it here. And then he goes a little further. He says, but for some of you, 6 years or 5 years or 4, 3, 2 years. Or even if you engage wholeheartedly, joyfully engage in the Dhamma, you might get it in a couple months, maybe a couple weeks, or maybe by the end of the sutta. Being pure, neither pleasure nor pain is seen. Again, evaluation has faded. We're simply present in our life as life occurs. Remember the Buddhist description of right view. Not, it's really a view that is resting in equanimity and non-reacting to any self-referential views because they're gone. It's a mind that's resting in peace. Just like the momentary but ever deepening peace that comes from a right concentration practice. So I think you've heard me say this before. Meditation, right meditation then, is a practical experience directly related to an awakened mind, and at the same time it's metaphor for that, isn't it? Because it describes the quality of an awakened mind. That common peace that we all feel in meditation. So then, from acknowledging that, ehepisiko, come and see for yourself, we then are integrating every time we acknowledge it and every time we deepen our concentration, we're integrating it on a deeper level within our mind and our body, which is where concentration belongs, doesn't it? Not externally focused. Any questions? I'm explaining this so wonderfully well. The Buddha continues. It is if one were sitting head to toe, another metaphor, it's as if one was sitting head to toe in a white cloth, their entire body covered. This is how a follower of the Noble Eightfold Path permeates their entire mind and body with pure, bright awareness. This is the fourth development of the five-factor noble concentration. So the use of the wrapping yourself in a cloth simply means that you have now developed a level of concentration where you are well protected from the distractions of the world. But yet you're able to be completely involved moment by moment as your life occurs. And again, I would bet that every one of you has had an experience of that, even if it's just briefly. But that's the fourth level of jhana. Furthermore, this follower of the Noble Eightfold Path has refined mindfulness well established. Their mindfulness is attended to, understood, and well penetrated by wise discernment. How do we know that we're developing right mindfulness or refined mindfulness? Because that mindfulness is resting in concentration and framed by the other seven factors of the Eightfold Path. Another word would be the eight-factor path. We're starting with that foundation of meditation and of deepening concentration, and as our concentration increases, we're able to hold in mind, that's what mindfulness means, to recollect or to hold in mind, we're able to hold in mind the other factors of the Eightfold Path as an integrated Dhamma practice. Is that clear? And that, again, it's such an important but obvious teaching. The Buddha taught an Eightfold Path, the path would be integrating that path, wouldn't it? But we can't do it with a distracted mind. Again, it's something else that the Buddha realized upon his awakening. How can I teach this way of recognizing the mind distracted by its own ignorance, prone to ignore its own ignorance? How can I pierce that veil of ignorance? That's why he taught an Eightfold Path, because it frames our thinking in such a remarkably effective way that very quickly we now have a reference point between our own ignorance and the reality that an awakened human being taught. Without that reference point, we wouldn't know where we're going, getting back to this, the whole point of this. Understanding that your Dhamma practice is developing and keeping it, as I'll teach in a couple of weeks in the Noble Search, keeping it the search a noble search and not becoming distracted by ignoble searches. Now that I mention it, basically what an ignoble search is searching in areas that are subject to the suffering inherent. In other words, you can't search in something that is prone to impermanence, to birth, sickness, aging, and death, and expect to understand impermanence by looking into what is prone to that. Which, think about that just for a moment, it's describing a very discursive way of looking at things, isn't it? You have to be able to step outside the problem somehow and go from a wrong view distracted by the problem to a right view that now has a broad and spacious understanding of what's occurring, the Buddha's description of right view. It is as if this person, when sitting, look at the simple description of how to know, and you can. The Buddha here is describing understanding what's skillful and what's not skillful. You've developed concentration and refined mindfulness to the level where you can actually trust your own judgment. Again, how do we know that? Because it fits within the framework of the Eightfold Path. It is as if this person, when sitting, knew another person as standing. It's pretty remarkable, huh? You simply know the difference. Or when standing, they knew another person as lying down. So too, this follower of the Noble Eightfold Path has refined mindfulness well established. Their mindfulness is attended to, understood, and well penetrated by wise discernment. This is the fifth development of the five-factor noble concentration. What is the fifth development? We simply know that we are now engaged in a practice that an awakened human being taught. We're engaged in the Eightfold Path. One of the seven factors of awakening that we've all talked about recently is skillful engagement, well, two factors, joyful engagement in Dhamma practice, but also actually studying the Dhamma, which makes sense, but it's also one of the factors of awakening, beginning with mindfulness, by the way. If we're going to develop something, we have to actually study it. If I want to learn how to change the oil in a car, I either have to learn from someone that can teach me or I go buy a manual. It's just like that with the Dhamma. But then I really don't know how to change the oil in a car until I actually do it. In the same way, we can't expect to understand the Dhamma until we actually experience it. That's the point of teaching these different levels of meditative absorption. The Buddha continues, their mindfulness is attended to, understood, and well penetrated by wise discernment. This is the fifth development of the five-factor noble concentration. When a follower of the Noble Eightfold Path has pursued and developed this five-factor noble concentration, they have mastered the six superior understandings. In most every translation I've ever read, the six superior understandings are often portrayed as the six higher learnings. And the Buddha didn't teach that, but from that misapplication of the term comes these mystical applications of what this means. And again, we all know the Buddha didn't teach anything that would take us out of our body. But often these are presented as clairvoyant or mystical understandings rather than a practical integration of the Eightfold Path. And so why would the Buddha take us down this road, stressing over and over again how important it is to integrate and practice only the Eightfold Path and then teach something that would take us out of that? He didn't do it. So the six superior understandings, and this relates to also directly to the Vitakka Santana Sutta, this person thinks what they want whenever they want and does not think what is unskillful. Through appropriate mindfulness, they understand the suffering of many from understanding their own suffering. And some of the descriptions of this level of being able to visualize the endless suffering that you've had going back endless lifetimes and into the future. What good is that? What usefulness is it? What's important to understand in this moment that I'm suffering because I have the right context because of my own ignorance of Four Noble Truths. They understand the suffering of many from understanding their own suffering. This is the true generation of compassion from knowing others' suffering because we know our own. They understand the arising and the passing away of the aggregates, five clinging aggregates. Again, this gets into mystical connotations of exploring different non-physical realms, which when you keep the Buddha's teaching in context, he cautioned against that. From lack of clinging, they are spacious, free, unbounded, unimpeded. Their form has no boundaries, meaning the form has no boundaries. Again, this is the mystical connotations is that we can fly across the cosmos and go here and go there. We can travel without our bodies. Again, what usefulness is that? And the Buddha never did that. He never materialized and dematerialized and did all that. It simply means that we have being, what's the word that I use? Their form has no boundary. Simply means I've stopped the extreme self-identification with this form, one of the five clinging aggregates. Doesn't mean that I don't have it. I'm not in it. In fact, I'm more in it when I stop self-referencing towards it. and developing mindfulness than I am when I'm constantly self-referencing, which is an objectified way of looking at ourselves, which is outside of our body. Any objectified thought is not unified in our body. From lack of clinging, they are spacious, free, unbounded, unimpeded. Their form has no boundaries and no self-distinction. This occurs to a practitioner whenever they are mindful and well-concentrated. Again, it's nothing extraordinary. Whenever we are mindful or well-concentrated, this occurs. Their ear consciousness, unbound, restrained, sounds are now unfettered and unsurpassed. This occurs to a practitioner whenever they are mindful and well-concentrated. When appropriate, mindful and well-concentrated, they understand the mindfulness and concentration of others. This is another factor of this. We understand others, concentration or lack of it, because we understand our own. We can tell it in others. I think it was with Frank this past Thursday about how he recognizes so readily when he's talking with someone who is really not well concentrated. And I think you would start noticing that too. Initially, that can even be a little bit off-putting. It's like, oh, why don't they calm down a little bit? Because we're struggling to understand them. Until we understand and have true compassion, and we actually become better listeners because we're not distracted by how another person should be. We can simply listen to them, even when they're not well concentrated. Why? Because we understand the nature of the loss of concentration.
I think you once said that you're so busy thinking about yourself when you're talking to someone that you can't possibly know what that person is feeling. You can't have compassion for that person because you're so tied up in the next thing you want to say or
that's right.
How it relates to you.
Yeah. And that's, again, that's what does a conditioned mind do? Confirmation bias. It interprets what other people are saying, not by what they're saying, by what you want them to say or the way that you interpret it yourself based on your own conditioned thinking. One of the most disturbing phrases that is very common is, I hear what you're saying. It doesn't really mean that you're listening to me, does it? It means you're interpreting from your own point of view. But a mind that is free of self-reference in the moment simply is mindfully present with what's occurring, including what other people are saying. You talk about all the hurtful rhetoric in the world today, and nobody's listening to them. I mean, not nobody, but the different ideological sides have lost the ability to listen to each other. And you know, I had lunch with Matt yesterday. That's the one thing that kind of concerns me about the world today, because we seem to be going further and further, beginning further and further entrenched in our ideologies, and we've lost the ability to listen to each other. Where are we going as a race if we can't even do that? And I don't want to make a political speech, but the way that this system is set up is to encourage that. But when that's no longer engaged in, we're in trouble. But it all goes back to what the Buddha described as a common human problem of ignorance of Four Noble Truths. If we're awakened, we can engage in useful discourse with other people simply because we can listen to them now. Doesn't mean we have to agree with everything, but we have gained the ability to listen. All practical developments of this, the Buddha continues. This is relating to this six higher understandings. They know a mind with passion as a mind with passion, we just talked about. They know a mind without passion, a calm and peaceful mind, as a mind without passion. They know a mind of aversion as a mind of aversion. They know a mind free of aversion as a mind free of aversion. They know a deluded mind as a deluded mind. How do we know? Because we have now a framework for evaluating this realistically and non-judgmentally. In other words, when I notice someone whose mind isn't free of aversion, my next thought isn't, what an awful person, or aren't I wonderful because I'm no longer free of aversion. That's all rooted in self-reference, and it's not an aspect of a well-concentrated mind. So again, the importance of developing a right meditation practice if we're hoping to be of benefit to others. Because otherwise, we get into this judgmental state of how others should be rather than understanding them purely as how they are. Do you see the difference? And do you see the relationship between losing directed thought and evaluation on our cushions? Because now off our cushions, I can simply be present with you. I don't have to evaluate you based on my own views of how you should be. I'm simply present with life as life occurs, including everyone around me. Is that important? I mean, did that make sense? Because that really is a key understanding of refined mindfulness. Does any, and you can be honest with me, I won't, there's no test. Does anybody not really get that? About the importance and the development of true concentration brings us into our life as our life occurs? Free of directed or evaluating thought.
That's the goal.
That is the goal. And again, the importance of understanding the jhanas and the reason why we meditate as we meditate is to make the connection between that meditation practice and then in our moment by moment life. And that's a direct experience of it. Excuse me. We gain the ability to be at peace with life as life occurs, no matter what the actual experience is. We gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it. They know a deluded mind as a deluded mind. They know a mind free of delusion as a mind free of delusion. They know a restricted mind as a restricted mind. They know a mind free of restriction as a mind free of restriction. They know a spacious mind as a spacious mind. They know a concentrated mind as a concentrated mind. They know a refined mind as a refined mind. And they know an unrefined mind as an unrefined mind. Going back to that description of when you're sitting, you know someone standing. When you're standing, you know someone lying down. That's the simple but wise discernment that we develop. They know a concentrated mind as a concentrated mind. They know a distracted mind as a distracted mind. They know a mind released from ignorance as a mind released from ignorance. What a marvelous quality to have, to be able to recognize that in someone. And the only way we could recognize it in someone else is because we've developed it ourselves. They know a mind clinging to ignorance as a mind clinging to ignorance. They know for themselves, direct experience, a well-concentrated mind supporting refined mindfulness. They know the arising and the passing away of bodies within the continuation of endless samsara. This is one of those lines where the descriptions are often, they understand the myriad many lives of others. That doesn't have any real relevance in understanding that human beings arise in the world and pass away in the world based on their understanding, and their experience in life is based on their understanding or lack thereof. That's the important thing to understand there. They understand their associations to people and the circumstances of wandering and ignorance. That means that, and the Buddha teaches us throughout his Dhamma, who and what we associate with is going to have a profound and lasting effect on the experience of our life. And in particular, so the Buddha cautioned against, and it doesn't mean we shouldn't engage and have relationships with people in the world, but we should be careful of how we associate with the people and events of the world as far as creating a self-referential view. And most importantly, what we associate with our Dhamma practice. Because even during the Buddha's time, he saw that very eager Dhamma practitioners were also hearing some other things that sounded fun or interesting or distracting or pleasant, and making that part of the Dhamma practice that the Buddha was teaching. And so he continually cautioned against that, because he understood the nature of distraction, or the nature of a mind rooted in ignorance, to find ways of continuing to ignore its own ignorance, including within the Buddha's, the original Sangha. So it's been a prevalent problem, and it continues to this day. They understand their associations with people and the circumstances of wandering and ignorance. They know karma and they know rebirth. And I won't get into the teachings, but the Buddha taught karma and rebirth because it was a significant part of the spiritual and religious lexicon of his time, but in a completely contradictory way, and in a way that reflects reality. Getting back to the sixth sense base the Buddha is referring to now, their eye consciousness, unbound, restrained, they see clearly the continuation of others bound to endless samsara according to their karma. Again, we're getting into the Buddha expressing a deeper and a broader view of his Dhamma, isn't it? We have to understand what karma really means. They understand the suffering of others rooted in bad conduct arising from wrong views. And that's another way of depersonalizing other people's actions And boy, we could use that today, couldn't we? We understand why people are acting in a certain way because they are ignorant of Four Noble Truths. They are deluded. They're rooted in greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. And again, I have to qualify when I say things like that, because I'm not just talking about one person or one ideology. It's rampant today. It's pervasive. They understand those bound to wrong views are also bound to continued suffering. Furthermore, their eye consciousness, unbound, restrained, they see clearly the arising and the passing away of others bound to endless samsara according to their karma. They understand the release of others rooted in good conduct arising from right views. And again, we're not talking about a moral way of looking at the world, good conduct in relation to the Eightfold Path. They understand those released from wrong views are also released from continued suffering. Let me say it again. The Buddha described awakened right view as knowledge with regard to stress, knowledge with regard to the origination of stress, knowledge with regard to the cessation of stress, and knowledge with regard to the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress. That's not in the sutta, that's one of my comments. In the sutta, but it's important to remember, this is why we're engaging in Dhamma practice. And all of these things help us keep well focused on what we're doing and why we're doing it. Thus, from establishing this five-factor concentration, they enter and remain free of the defilements of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. They are mindful of their release through direct experience right here and now. Again, it's not something we have to do forever. If we develop it the way it's designed, and the way it's taught, the way it's directly experienced, awakening occurs right here and right now. They know this for themselves due to a well-concentrated mind supporting refined mindfulness, probably the most important direction. They know this for themselves due to a well-concentrated mind supporting refined mindfulness. That's in the sutta, and I would say refined mindfulness that can integrate the entire Eightfold Path. This is what the Buddha said. Gratified, those assembled were delighted in the Buddha's words. It's the end of the sutta. Thank you for listening to me. Any direct questions on what I just talked about, and then we'll go around the room. Okay. Judy.
So deep in concentration, I mean, this seems like a very elemental question to me, but it's just while you're meditating, having less and less directed thought and more in the state of being with your breath.
Yes, and that's really it. And maybe just to put a little clarity on directed thought, the Buddha doesn't teach a meditation method to develop a trance-like state, meaning a state that we are not recognizing our thoughts. I could teach you all this in 5 minutes. We could all be in a trance. And that trance could last as long as we decide we want it to. I don't teach it because it's just another distraction. If you've lost the ability to think, you've lost your mindfulness. So what good is it? So it's simply a way of not being distracted by our own thoughts and using the breath as the most expedient tool for concentration. So again, it's in that moment that we have put aside directed thought. And for most of us, in the next moment or two, or three or four or five, we're going to find ourselves thinking again. Mm-hmm. What do we do? Well, come back to the breath. It doesn't mean that all is lost or that we're doing something wrong. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's only wrong if we start judging that, oh, I'm not doing this right, or this is so frustrating, or you know, why my mind can't come back to the sensation of breathing. Free, and that is the going from the second jhana, directed thought and evaluation, I'm not doing it right, or it's too hard, or everybody else in the world can meditate, but I can't. That's the second level. You're aware of those thoughts. Hopefully you're not distracted by them, because then you can sink into the third level where that's not an issue in your own mind anymore. Mm-hmm. And again, the third jhana may only be for a brief moment. It doesn't matter. Recognize that you've developed that, and from that recognition, continue with your practice, and you will, just to use the metaphor, drop down into the fourth level. And as we see the value of meditation in recognizing the ever-deepening levels of meditative absorption, we are then able to take that recognition and incorporate it off our cushion. It's just that way. We've learned how to change the oil in a car, so now I can tell you, because I've had the direct experience. Great question. Thank you for asking. It's just about 10 o'clock. Does anybody have to run out? Because I'll put you on a hot seat first. Okay, good. Lorna, good to see you.
That was a very intense talk, John.
Yeah. Was it?
I think how I get to a more concentrated state in meditation, which the Buddha didn't mention, so maybe I was right, I don't know, but I think when you're meditating, if you become aware of your thoughts, and now you're thinking about this, and come back to your breath, and now you're thinking about that, and another thought comes in, you're back to your breath, and just seeing the impermanence of your thoughts, I think gives you a personal release that just how fleeting thoughts are and our emotions. And so when you look at impermanence, even in your meditation like that, that and understanding that can give you a release, which then would, as you said, drop you down into the next jhana when your thoughts are more stable on your breath, because you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, it's the whole point, really,
yeah.
Isn't it?
So, but the Buddha didn't mention that.
Well, he did in the other descriptions, like in the six higher understandings or six superior knowledges, about recognizing the impermanence. In this description, it's an objectified view, but also in all of the other teachings, they point back to understanding the three marks of existence, which is really what we're doing here. The impermanence between each level of jhana is important to recognize, and it also keeps us free of grasping at. I've recognized now that I'm past directed thought and evaluation. Since I understand the impermanence of even that, I won't grasp onto that as an accomplishment. And it's important, you know, just since you brought it up, thank you, that to not look at these deepening levels of concentration as any type of attainment. It's not. It's just part of an ordinary meditation practice that we should be mindful of and be aware of.
And then you use the phrase, when our environment permeates us. I don't know if I've heard that phrase. I probably have, but it hasn't sort of permeated me.
Yeah.
I can just relate to that so clearly, so instantly.
Yeah, you've described that to me repeatedly over the.
That's how our thoughts just get wrapped up in the environment and in our lives and all that.
Yeah.
The environment permeates us and permeates our thinking. And you can relate that to, in the Sutta the Buddha described, if you can hold that thought in mind and see that, the Buddha's teachings give you the opportunity to wrap yourself in a white cloth or something, whatever. Just to give you a shield, so you're just not so susceptible to life's ups and downs and, you know, these backhanders that life throws at you now and again. You know, you can undersee it. You can see it more clearly.
Yeah.
In your practice.
That using the word "it's a shield" is the appropriate word. The Buddha teaches his Dhamma, and he often characterizes his way as a protection from what's occurring in the world. A that's the Ratana Sutta on the triple refuge. That's what it means. This is a practice that is a true refuge. It's a protection. It's a place of safety and comfort in a world that the Buddha described 2,600 years ago as on fire. Well, it still is, isn't it? And again, it doesn't disengage us from the world in a way of that we're no longer effective or living in the world, but we're no longer affected by what's occurring in the world because we've developed a well-concentrated mind and we understand reality. We understand, as the Buddha described here, the nature of suffering arising and passing away. And that description that you gave a couple of years ago now, of that your breath is here and your mind is down here. That Buddha's referring to that here too, isn't he? And in that metaphor, that's a, it's such a good metaphor for just to think about that. That, you know, beginning meditation, our minds is the top of a inland lake. There's nothing coming in or out. But as we meditate, we simply drop down into that calm and peaceful state immediately. Thank you, David. Good to see you this morning.
Thank you for your teaching.
Glad you're here. Daniel, good to see you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Welcome to our Sangha for the first time here.
Yeah, thanks. It was great. Until here you speak again. Yeah, everything's been good. I've incorporated a nice meditation practice in the morning, even though I get up early for work. That's been going very well.
Great.
And, you know, with regard to deepening concentration and remaining, as my concentration gets deepened, that I'm recognizing a difference between staying present in my body and with my breath, as opposed to finding that deepening sense of relaxation and attaching to it and trying to hold on to it.
Yeah.
And like that being the goal. So now it's different. It seems upside down, whereas now I'm kind of just getting more rooted in myself and the experience of the meditation, rather than the goal of it. So that's been helpful. So thank you.
Thank you for sharing. That's outstanding. And you recognize the value in that.
Mm. Oh, absolutely.
Seeing it, it's really the difference between a right view and a wrong view of meditation, isn't it? It's not for achieving anything other than a well-concentrated mind, which we know is, and I got a question maybe a year ago, I can't really remember how long, from an online student, and I never was asked this question before. He says, why did the Buddha meditate after he was awakened? I'm like, you know, why wouldn't he? Why would you stop? Thank you, Dan. Judy, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good to be here, John. I'm fine. It's a really good sutta this morning. Lots of food.
Yeah.
For thought.
There's a lot.
My practice is going very well, and I look forward to it, and on a level I haven't before. So that I like that, and I find I'm, you know, these days mindful about when dukkha arises, that I'm aware in my head of, well, this isn't permanent, it's only what's happening now, and it's good, and like, but it enters my body, it permeates my body, and lets my nervous system, even though I'm saying this in my head,
yeah,
I can feel it in my body, and I think, yeah, I'm not sleeping tonight. And, you know, and that's really hard for, that. I haven't had that breakthrough yet, where what I, you know, I'm saying to myself up here can replace or permeate, you know, instead of what's happening outside of me.
Yeah.
So that continues to be a challenge, but that's the work. Right?
That's the work, yeah. And if I could put words in your mouth, developing the Buddha's teachings has had a remarkable impact on your life, hasn't it?
It has.
And in a very entirely practical way. That's why the Buddha taught this, you know. To me, it's most remarkable in that way, and how successful it is to very quickly take us from a distracted state to a well concentrated state, and the benefit of that. Thank you, Judy.
Okay.
Tell Andrew I said hello, please.
I will.
Luke, good to see you again.
Good to be back. I've been steady, like I said, with my practice.
Good.
And kind of reflecting on my practice through my family, through my children. I had kind of an epiphany. I had to go to Florida for a work thing, so I brought my whole family with me, and we did a couple days in Disney.
Wow.
And that was that was a little profound, just in, you know, walking around with talking about a bunch of people that are asleep and stuff in their face with low vibrational type substances and all that kind of stuff. It was just like that judgment that you guys were talking about sort of came out.
Yeah.
You know, definitely feeling, you know, superior to all these other people and sort of just sort of caught up in the judgment of the whole thing and just feeling like a Dufco machine in that situation. So I stayed, you know, steady with my practice. I got up early and meditated right in front of my, like, it was real claustrophobic in my room, just had a little spot that I threw my pillow off the bed and sat in the morning, and like it was just so essential and so nourishing, and like I just proved to myself that, you know, 100% that it's just an absolute essential in my daily life, and I have to go to it. So I was with my family for a couple of days, and I got separated because I had to go to my class, and my oldest son, who's 8 years old, he was riding around on the buses and going crazy through the parks and everything, and she took a picture of him sitting on the bus, you know, separated from the rest of the family, sitting there meditating.
Wow.
So like, for the, I just had this like kind of a sense of
that's great.
Just complete satisfaction of setting that example for them.
Yeah.
And I so needed this practice early on in my life, and I had a lot of loss, family loss, in these last couple of years, and that's what really drove me to Matt. You know, I started getting acupuncture right here in these rooms, and started this whole kind of a journey. So like having and developing these tools as a youngster and having that to work with, it was like I couldn't be any more happy with the journey I'm on and the reason I'm doing it and everything else. So it's like, it's really good.
Yeah, permeated with the joy of the practice, huh? But thank you for sharing that, Luke. And it's remarkable, and it's not so remarkable. That's the whole point of recognizing that. And even when you found that you were, I think you used the Dukkha machine, you used that to describe yourself, it didn't sound like you were judging yourself harshly. You're just, this is just what's occurring now. That's so key. That's why I always don't be gentle with yourself. The important thing is, and it's remarkable that you did recognize it and come back to the practice and the profound changes. And now, and your son, just from your own example, is starting to meditate. That's how the Buddha, he never beat anybody up with his practice saying you have to do this or you should do this. He just said, if you do it, this is what you can expect. And people did it. That's great. Thank you. Glad you're here this morning. Anthony, good to see you. Welcome back from Florida as well.
Thank you. Yeah. I was listening to Luke's story. I was thinking, "Wow, mine couldn't be more opposite." I wasn't judging people, but maybe that's because I was in the Keys in Miami,
yeah,
or Disney World. There might have been more judging in that for me also. But I found it really difficult to meditate every day in the hotel room with my wife cleaning up and getting ready and brushing her teeth, and or sitting at the edge of the bed waiting for me to be done. And I found it challenging.
Yeah.
So I was relating to what you said about your environment permeates you.
Yeah.
But I stuck to it and I meditated every day. Sometimes I made compromises with myself that I do 10 minutes or 15 instead of 20.
Yeah.
But I could see that, I could notice that I might form a temporary judgment about a noise or something, but I would go back to it and I didn't really dwell on it. I just noticed that it's very difficult when you change your environment, and I leave the cushion, I didn't have a cushion, and things weren't so good, that it becomes more of a challenge. But
yeah.
I looked at it as like a peak and valley situation. You know, it's pretty similar to when you have a lot of stress or a lot of problems in your life, your meditations aren't as good in that particular moment, but they're just as important because you can then build up again.
Yes, yes.
You know, and then you appreciate the better environments more because you went through the tougher environments.
Yeah. And you don't lose any of that. You know, it's there. Once you build the foundation, it's there. And this gets you away. You're describing not getting caught up in spiritual attainment, you know, that I should be able to meditate anywhere. Well, the Buddha didn't go and meditate on the equivalent of Times Square just to prove how advanced he was. He meditated in seclusion. that's the best way to have a practice. And when you can't do that, you simply do the best you can and don't judge it. And you even described going from the second level to the third level, that you heard a noise, you didn't evaluate it, it just came back to your breath. That's developing
jhana. Yeah, it's just the frequency of it is more intense.
Yeah.
It's more noise, it's more distractions, but it's like having, it's like driving through a highway of bumps.
Yeah.
You just have to keep driving, but you got to encounter the bumps.
Yeah, you reminded me, years and years ago, I used to go to Shivananda Yoga Center, and I think it's on 23rd Street, maybe. Yeah, doesn't really matter. And New York is noisy, you know, it is. You can't get away from it. And I didn't realize this until much later when I stopped doing it, but I used to think how remarkable it was that I could meditate with all that noise. All I was doing was thinking about how remarkable it was to meditate with all that noise.
Yeah, and I was listening to Luke thinking, man, he's got his whole family in the room with him. Like,
that's amazing.
Would have been tougher for me.
Yeah. I don't know that I could. I know I could. I could meditate with the different families I've been a part of. Certainly with my brothers and sisters, they'd be throwing spitballs at me. Mary, so good to see you today. I'm glad you're here.
I've been on a roller coaster as usual. I've had some physical issues, which have been only seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. My biggest mistake was coming to see a specialist. I should know better. The meds are not the answer. And, you know, and then I had my brother-in-law passed away this past week. It wasn't a surprise, but it's still rough. It's a rough ride.
Still a loss.
A lot of trouble concentrating, a lot of trouble. A lot of trouble pulling my head out of the hole. And so I'm back and I'm going to go home and listen to the lecture again and get back on the wagon and get back on a strict twice a day meditation ritual and try to get some levelness going in my head.
Yeah. Great. Thank you for all that. Sorry for your loss, but you know from your own direct experience the value of the Dhamma practice and to keep you balanced. And that, again, from your own experience, not just recently, life happens, you know, but we always come back to this true refuge of the Dhamma no matter what. It's just the best way to deal with the vagaries of life, isn't it? Thank you, Mary. Melissa, good to see you. Welcome to our Frenchtown Sangha.
Thank
Melissa
you.
Was also on our last retreat.
It was, as you watched me have my mind blown on the retreat, which I know was bringing it back has been very interesting, you know, practicing Ram, 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 Ram for hours was so much simpler to just listen to my breath. And the enormity of that change passed quickly, but I was still fascinated by it for many days, how the veil was just gone and the permanence and non-permanence, all the subtle ways I made reference to myself to keep me rooted in my mind when really uniting my mind and my body was the key, and
yeah,
how listening and coming back to the breath, what that really meant, what that really felt like, and how easy it is when I'm not saying Ram, 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 Ram.
Distracted
and,
by it.
Or, you know, doing my 108 mala beads because I'm still thinking, and it's been delightful in my mind, and I'm so grateful to have had so many changes over the years to eliminate music that's not helpful to my mind, or TV, and there's no sound. You know, I'm a very quiet and steady life, and all of it was right there just waiting for me to make that one change to my breath so I can learn to concentrate, because I used to say I had space. You know, I need to meditate in ROM so I can have space for my next thoughts. But see, all I did was keep to my mind, because I have to concentrate to use those other seven tools.
Yeah.
So it's the space. I had the space. Now I can put the tools inside that space and stay in the Eightfold Path, and it's effortless. And my need to explain it to someone is not present yet. Everyone's asked, how has it been? How has it been? They're used to me going to Shivananda ashrams and coming back and telling them how I've learned to chant now with all the syllables and I'm going to make it.
Yeah.
This time it's not like that. It's no desire yet to articulate this to many people. So it's just been a beautiful refuge in my mind, and I am eternally grateful for that retreat.
Thank you, Melissa, for sharing that. It's you describe it so well, you know, from going from a wholesome practice, but not really bearing any fruit until, and then you see how simple and direct this is, and you have the immediate visceral experience of a developing concentration. And it's just that way. It's remarkable. When I finally discovered what an awakened human being actually taught, it changed everything. Everything. And yet, I'm still in the same body, living in the same world, you know. Much nicer people. But again, from the outside, you couldn't, my brothers and sisters don't see any difference, you know. I'm still the black sheep in the family, I always will be. That goes back over 40, oh, almost 50 years to the establishment of that. What a wonderful class. A few quick announcements. We've gotten a little bit longer. I do try to finish these by 10. We are putting the finishing touches on beginning, Matt and I are doing this, putting the finishing touches on a teacher training that we're going to begin next year. That all generated from a question I got from an online student. He said, so, old man, what's going to happen to you and your practice and your teaching when you're gone, when the cow gets you? And I honestly hadn't thought about that. There is something very rare and special here. And I'm going up on a retreat with Matt, you know, we talked about it. And he really came up with it. He said, let's start a formalized teacher training. And I think it's a great idea. Whether I live for another 40 years or hopefully another year to get through the initial phase of that. So we're going to start that next year. There's going to be some easy to fulfill requirements. We're going to actually go through, and beginning with next year, the environment of our Sangha will reflect some of the requirements for teacher training. But again, I don't see this as something that is particularly advanced. It just means you have a thorough understanding of the Dhamma and a willingness to teach others. And then over the summer, we're going to go through, probably on Thursday nights, an actual course on deepening your understanding of the Dhamma. It's going to be very similar to our retreats, by the way. And then some more feedback and instruction from me about how to teach and why I teach it. And I think that'll be interesting. And then it will probably culminate with a teacher's retreat up at Wan Dharma Center in the late winter of 2019, or the meaning late in the year of 2019 or early in 2020. So that's coming up. So I hope many of you will partake of that. And the idea, for as long as the old man is still here, I'm not that old, but I'm 63. My body's been through a lot. The cow is always right back there. Initially, it'll mean that those of you that have been through the teacher training will start teaching some classes here and give me a little bit of break and let me sit over there once in a while. So that's how it will begin. And then hopefully there'll be enough of a structure established to continue this. Again, because this is rare in the world, and it's something that Matt and I hope all of you agree is something worth preserving. So that's the focus. Our Dana dinner is set November 20th, Tuesday of Thanksgiving week. I encourage all of you to come. It's a remarkable community dinner. I'll give you some more information about that. But because of the incredible response to Galasso's fire from the mayor, the council, and the different fire departments, I've specifically invited, or will be inviting, all of them. I contacted Brad Meyer, the mayor here in town, and he graciously accepted. I'm going to get a hold of the town council, and hopefully they can come, and the various fire departments. I think there were 6 or 7 that actually responded, and the rescue squads and the police department. So we usually have somewhere around 90 to 100. I think the first dinner we had 160. We're going to have about 600 or 700 people at the dinner this year. We'll see what happens. But again, just put the date aside and please come. I'll have some more information on that. And that's enough for today. Thank you. And this series is going to, of jhana is going to continue for the next week or so. because I just think it's so important. And our Sangha has developed to the point where the core members, which is really all of you in the Tuesday Sangha, are ready to fine-tune your meditation practice. And again, I mean it that way. It's fine-tuning. It's not any type of an advanced practice. So we'll finish with metta, as we always do. So again, find your relaxed meditation posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, admitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace.
Thank you, John. Thank you, John.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.